Blog Talk Radio.
We need more linear thinking at this point. Oh, yes. Does that mean that we forget the intuition? Not at all. Does that mean we forget the oral tradition? Not at all. But it means then that while maintaining those traditions, we also must enhance other aspects of our personality. We want to look a bit at culture. What is culture? And we should ask this again. I admire Chancellor Williams very much. And I think the destruction of black civilization, of course, is a magnificent book, and I've said many times.
She's just convalescing, guy. He calls them senior citizens' homes. But they will put them away and throw the key away and forget them. And to satisfy their evil way,
opening the eyes and exposing the retina to the environment. It means as follows. She, Marcel Gibert, used the famous Gazelle test for early intelligence developed at Yale University's Child Development Center. The pictures of the 48-hour child, two-day-old child, supported only by the forearms, both upright, perfect head balance,
situation within, you know, when you start to become analytical in psychology and particularly how it applies to our people, you know.
In a way to support the dominant system, and in this instance to support white domination. So it becomes very important that whatever we talk about it in context. Because the major ruse that is used in the academies is to decontextualize subject matter. That is to take subject matter out of context and to project it as race neutral and objective. So as a matter of fact, when you read your newspapers, you will see the same kind of game going on. You will get discussions of black-on-black violence, the homicide among our young men, and you will get half explanations or half-truths, such as these young men are killing each other because of the availability of guns. You know, somehow it's just the mere availability of guns that's causing black-on-black homicide, or just the selling of drugs, or other half explanations. We have to watch out for that, because often the other half is the most important one, the one that is left out. How are the guns distributed? Who manufactures them? Who sells them? And the whole bit. Who imports the drugs? Who distributes the drugs? Or it's the cause of poverty. Crime is caused by poverty, caused by poor family background. We get a whole plethora of these kind of half-truth definitions. These guns are made available within a social political context. Drugs are made available within a social political context. Families are broken apart within a social political context. Poverty is created within a social political context. Poor education is the result of a social political context, ladies and gentlemen. And we must constantly then look at that context and see how it creates the conditions of which we complain so much. We must then recognize, as we begin to look at black upon black violence. We must see that violence and its connections to a racist society. And we must come to understand what a racist society is about. We use that term so often without analyzing it very well. And we must recognize essentially then that a racist society is about structuring social and political, economic circumstances, psychological and cultural circumstances, such that one race can take advantage of another. And one race can enhance itself at the expense of another. It has little to do with overt race hatred or with negative racial attitudes or with the projection of racial stereotypes or, as Brother Harris says, with whites not understanding the nature of their racism. That's not it. And when you define it in terms of attitudes, you'll find yourself then solving the wrong problems. These people will stop expressing those negative attitudes, you see. They will smile more regularly at you. They will even marry you and go to bed with you, sleep with you. But you will note that the effects of racism, the effects of poverty and all of these other things will continue. But not only do they continue, they increase. Ultimately, you must recognize that racism involves the power of one race to impose its will upon another. That ultimately then it is about power. And we have to face that fact. Whites engage in racism because they have the power to do so. And if we are to end white racism, then we must end white power. We use the word imperialistic society and imperialism often, also without looking at it very deeply and looking at the term very deeply. Imperialism of empire. Speaking then of a group of people who through various means have acquired and maintained an empire, who maintain and exploit control over populations much larger than themselves. We heard a reference here tonight about this population being 5%, the white population here of the world, and about the total European population being about 10%, yet in control of 80% of the world's economic resources, and in control of the other 90% of the world's populations. You're talking about empire then, ladies and gentlemen. And what does that imply? That means then you have a small population that is ruling over populations that are much, much, much larger than it is. And of course, we don't have time to talk about the psychology of this, but I've often indicated that this can only be possible when that small population maintains the larger populations in a state of false consciousness and in a state of deception. That this small population can only maintain control over those larger populations by outright lying and the falsification of reality. But recognize, in essence then, in terms of the problems we are talking about here this evening, the Colin Powells, the black soldiers in the armies, you have to recognize that the essential nature of imperialism is that due to the fact that the imperialist group or nation that runs the empire is so small compared to the empire, it must of necessity recruit from the very population it rules in order to control that empire. When you study the history of imperialism, particularly the history of imperialism as regards African people, which has been going on now for over 2,000 years, When you look at the history of imperialism and colonialism on the African continent, and you study Chancellor Williams' books, and you look at the history of imperialism in Africa, you cannot help but recognize that non-European imperialism and European imperialism has been aided by Africans who were recruited into the armies of the imperialistic masters and were used to practice black upon black violence against their African brothers in the name of their European masters. So then when I talk about black upon black violence in this book, or we talk about the young men and women in the U.S. Army today, recognize then that we are talking about nothing new, but something that is continuous with the very essence and nature of imperialism and racism. Recognize also that when we talk about black-on-black violence, we are talking about a violence that violence produced. That black-upon-black violence is reflective of white-on-black violence. And that ultimately it reflects the violence that this Eurocentric and European community has practiced upon black people and our reactions to that violence. When we then talk about a racist society, an imperialistic society, recognize then that we are talking about a crimogenic society. What do we mean by crimogenic society? Of course, racism is a crime against humanity and a crime against our race. Imperialism is a crime against our race as well. And therefore, when you have a racist society and an imperialistic society, you have a crimogenic society. What do we mean then by a crimogenic society? Of course, dealing with the word genesis, we are talking about the idea of generating the beginning, as in the word genesis, to begin, the source of, the point of creation of. So when we talk about this society as a crimogenic society, we are talking about this society then as the source of crimes, as the generator of criminality, as the creator of criminals, a society that is run by criminals, and a society then that ultimately criminalizes its population and criminalizes the total system. I had a piece here, you know, there's some of you here who are middle class and you think you're nice. You think you're non-criminal. A criminal society criminalizes all of its constituents. I don't have time tonight to read to you the justification for that piece. Oh, there's some of you who've been in the church and you think you're good. Read in Black on Black Violence, where I talk about your dumb goodness. A goodness that maintains sin and criminality. We don't have time to talk about it tonight. You're in the church, but you're guilty too. Because you see, ladies and gentlemen, when the leadership of a nation lies to that nation, when it deceives that nation, when it miseducates that nation and falsifies facts, it falsifies the consciousness of the people who inhabit that nation. And when it falsifies their consciousness, it recruits those of its people into its criminality. So whether you know it or don't know it, you're a part of the game. Oh, yes. We have to confront our responsibility for this criminal situation as well. Yes, we do. Whether you're looking at us as so-called middle class, remember those of you who are making it in this society, who are making great profits, great accomplishments, sitting at the same tables with your white masters. That you're sitting and profiting from the death and murder and destruction of your ancestors. That as you eat with your white masters, you are eating the flesh and spirits of your people. You can cover it up and lie to yourself and claim it's your individual striving that got you where you're going. That you are taking advantage of opportunities. But remember, these opportunities were based on the death and destruction of African people and the continuing death and destruction of African people. Those of you rolling around in the church and carrying on in the same position as well. But let me continue. This society is a society of criminals, run by criminals, and it is a creator of criminals. And we must recognize it. And I have to say that because we got some people out here who say, I want my children to be just like them. That's the ultimate goal. I don't want there to be any differences. What are you talking about? You want them to be enslavers, rapists and robbers and killers and murderers and imperialists and so forth, just like the other folk, right? Think again, ladies and gentlemen. But due to our time, I'm just going to have to rush through here. I accuse the society of being a crimogenic society, a criminal society. A society that engages in white on black violence for a number of reasons. And of course, as you can tell, often the psychology of an individual or a people in terms of their origins and early childhood experiences, you can look at then the psychology of a people in terms of their origins and early childhood of their race. And when we look then at the origins of this society, we must immediately recognize that it is a society founded on criminal activities. Yes, and that is its inheritance today. It is still a part of it. A society that is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages on white, on black violence, because it is founded on the murder and theft of Indian peoples and Indian lands. It is a crimogenic society, a criminal society, and a society that practices white on black violence, because it is a society founded on the kidnapping of African people, the manslaughter of African people in the mid-passage, the extortion from African people of their labor, and the enslavement of African people. Therefore, the very nature and foundations of this society rest on two massive genocidal crimes, and this original crime is a part of its nature today. It is a crimogenic society because this group of people cannot face their own criminality. They must engage in the psychology of denial and repression and distortion. And this denial and distortion and repression must suffuse throughout the total society, throughout its total institutions, throughout its total values, and therefore ultimately it must pervert its total population. It is a criminal society and a white-on-black violent society because it engages in the crime of breach of contract. It has breached the contract of its constitution. It breached the contracts it made with African people during the Reconstructions. It breached its contracts of the 14th, 15th, and other amendments. It breached its contracts in reversing its rulings in the 1860s, 1870s, 1980s, and 1990s. It breached its contracts in terms of sharecropping, the peonage of our people, going back on the 40 acres and a mule, and all the rest of the things. It is a criminal society because it constantly engages in assault and battery against its black populations. It engaged in historical lynching, and behind the walls, as my brother mentioned here, of prisons, it still now engages in legal lynchings of African people. It engages in Klan terrorism, which it's still engaged in today. It engages in race riots, where it destroys the African people. It engages in police riots, and it engages in police brutality, where over 300 or more of our young men and women have been destroyed in the city of New York alone. It is a criminal society, and it is a crimogenic society, and a society that engages in white-on-black violence, because it is indicted on the charges of official malfeasance when it revokes its mandate in terms of giving justice to its people and makes this justice system an instrument of injustice, when its so-called rehabilitative system is a school for criminality. It engages in official malfeasance when it rigs its juries, when it legally lynches the ones it so woefully sentences. It engages in official malfeasance when it engages in gerrymandering of black districts, when it betrays the mandates of black voters, when it builds, as my brother mentioned here, prisons as industries so that the incarceration of black men becomes a profit-making industry and a means by which the ruling class makes war against the subordinate classes. It engages in criminal activity, and it is a criminal society when it engages in unfair labor practices, job discrimination, when at the end of the Reconstruction there were more black skilled workers than there were whites, and the whites unionized to keep the blacks from taking advantage of the opportunities that were available to them. It is indicted for labor racketeering when it runs black men away from its construction sites, when we go into a black community where housing is supposedly being made and built for black residents, and we see few, if any, black men building those houses. And when those black men come to work on those sites, they are chased away by the police and the construction workers. And when they are chased away and made to stand on the corners, then they are accused of refusing to work and desiring not to work. We accuse this society of being a crimogenic society, of being a criminal organization, of being an organization that engages in chronic white-on-black violence, when it engages in drug trafficking, when it imports the drugs that poisons our neighborhoods and destroys the consciousness of our people, destroys their health. We see a crimogenic people from way back engaging in the selling of opium to the Chinese and in engaging in opium wars. We see this drug trafficking group of people engaging in alcohol addiction when they used it to destroy Indians, when they used it to destroy African chiefs who, under the influence of the alcohol, often signed away their peoples and their nations. We accuse it of drug addiction and drug trafficking when it traded guns for drugs to carry on its warfare in Central and South America, We accuse it of being a criminal nature, a criminal people, a criminal nation, a crimogenic society, when it engages in gun running across the world, when it sells the very weapons that will be used to destroy its own sons and daughters. We accuse it of criminality when it acts to maintain an evil military-industrial complex. We accuse it of being a criminal society when it sells its death wares across the world. How many of us recognize that we are dealing here with merchants of death? That these people are dead and deadly. People who are robbing black people at home so that they can rob black people abroad. We accuse this nation of being a crimogenic society and the ruling white population of being a criminal people, because they engage in economic extortion, taxation of black people without representation, the redlining of black communities as they steal the savings and investment of black people, as they disinvest in the black community, as they do not return loans to the black community and use the monies that the black communities and the black church place in their coffers to export jobs out of the community into suburbs beyond the black, to the reach of the black population. When they export jobs outside of the country totally and starve our black men and women in Detroit and the other urban centers of this world, we accuse them of economic extortion when they deindustrialize this nation and ship out the blue-collar jobs that maintain the families of black people across this country and ship them to other places and exploit the other populations of this world. We accuse them of imperial criminality and of organized crime. This nation is an organized mafia operation. I have indicated to you that it is best when you look at the international situation that you will come away with a better understanding if you apply the concepts of mafia psychology to the international relations that are going on right now and that have been going on. We don't have time to talk about a chapter I do in here that I call Quantifying the Myth. You know, the myth of making black people appear to be more criminal than white people, a myth that is statistically supported by the number of black men and women arrested, by the number of black men and women incarcerated, by the number of black men and women under probation and parole. And of course, now we are supposed to look at those statistics and compare them between black and white. And because we see more blacks arrested, more blacks in jail, more blacks in probation and parole, we are supposed to make the illogical assumption that blacks are more criminal than whites. I told you time and time again, ladies and gentlemen, that in a society that's based on lies, as this one is, in a society that can only exist based on deception, that truth is reversed. That's in essence what a lie is. And therefore, when you look at the so-called statistics that seek to establish the criminality of black people, turn it around and turn them around, and you will recognize that the criminals are outside the prisons. We don't have time to talk about it tonight, but that's the value of having power, you see. You can make criminal whatever you want to make it. You can legitimize your own criminality and perverseness. You can call virtue a crime and arrest people for being virtuous. And then you can look at the statistics and say, aren't they more criminal because they are in jail? Some of you read the recent situation here in the Hasidic community where a bunch of Jews ran out, broke arms, and hurt the police, but about 2 or 3 dozen policemen. This, of course, comes after a time when they broke into a police precinct station and ransacked it. How many of those people went to jail? How many got fingerprinted? How many of them are in prison? And so forth. And yet, can we say that they did not commit a crime? You see, what do we have here then? A situation, you see, where if you use crime statistics, you're not going to find those Hasidic Jews in the statistics. You're not going to find them on the prison rolls. You see, that's what power does for you, isn't it? It permits you to commit a crime and keep yourself out of jail. And then you can go into the jailhouse and look at the statistics and compare the number of blacks arrested on probation, on parole, and compare them with Hasidic Jews. And say, well, I see one is very big and the other one is very little. Therefore, the blacks must be more criminal than the Hasidic Jews. You can never be more wrong in your life. You have to understand, but we have to get away from that. You know, and this is the kind of teaching that goes on in the university today. Understand that when white boys and white girls are not on the rolls, the prison rolls, and in the prison populations, it points to the efficiency of their criminal organization. How do we say that? A mafia don who has a very efficient criminal operation, who can create a murder incorporated, who can engage in drug trafficking and killing and murdering and extortion, the same kind of games I've been reading to you here tonight, can earn so much money until he can keep his children innocent, keep them out of jail, give them good educations, and the whole bit. You understand what I'm getting at? In other words, those children's names do not appear on the crime blotters. They are not in the jails because their fathers are such good mafia operators. So even their innocence speaks to the efficient criminality of their fathers. And because then the white boys are not in jail with the black boys, do not make the assumption that means the white boys are less criminal or their fathers are less criminal. It means they just have a criminally efficient operation. We got to move on here. This country then is an imperialist criminal operation because it robs the people at home, and you see it as it robs the people abroad. It constricts the black males to fight its criminal wars. It maintains worldwide terror and extortion. It, of course, maintains the criminality in Namibia, South Africa, Angola, Panama, Grenada, Central South America, Zaire, and the whole bit. I accuse this nation of being a criminal nation because it engages in the health neglect of our people. This nation, as determined by its own task force, indicates that black and minority health, in the area of black and minority health, there are 60,000 more minority deaths per year based on an expectation of equal death rates for blacks and whites. As a matter of fact, melanin gives you an added lifespan. So what are we saying here? That this society, due to its neglect of the health of black people, excesses the lives of some 60,000 black people a year. This is murder. It engages in child neglect and child abuse as it maintains the infant mortality rate of black children to more than twice that of white children, as it maintains a measles rate 16 times that of white children, as it maintains the poverty of our black children, increasing the poverty of black children at the rate of some 750,000 children a year. It engages in educational neglect, as it engages in the miseducation of our children, as it refuses to fund the Head Start and early childhood education programs, as it refuses to fund the education programs under Chapter 1. And I wish I had the time to read the statistics here of how our children are killed and our families are destroyed through educational neglect. This criminal society then sets up the psychology of black-on-black violence by creating a sense of powerlessness in our young people, by projecting negative stereotypes upon their mentality, such that they seek to escape an African identity and alienate themselves from their African selves and internalize the values and perceptions projected by the dominant society, as their appetites are distorted so that they literally then eat themselves to death or desire things which will destroy them, as it frustrates them such that in their anger they turn against themselves, as it makes them displace their anger against their fellow victims. This society is a criminogenic society because it serves as the best model of criminality. The black-on-black criminal has learned from the best of teachers, the white-on-black criminal. It engages in criminality as it supplies weaponry to our children and alcohol and drugs. How does this relate then to our adolescents? Recognize that almost 50% of the young men who die between 15 and 24 die as a result of homicide, black-on-black homicide. This would be a major health problem if we were another ethnic group. Recognize that the cream of the African race is being destroyed before it has a chance to reach manhood. Homicide is the leading cause of death of black males between 15 and 24. Is it because, ladies and gentlemen, if you look at the demographic situations in this country, we are producing and outproducing white people in terms of children? You must understand that at a rate of almost 3 or 4 to 1. The Hispanics are outproducing them about 5 or 6 to 1. That means the larger part of the up-and-coming population is going to be black and Latino. And these people have already written about the birth dearth. And so what do we have here then, ladies and gentlemen? The destruction of a race and the destruction of that group that would move us toward being a majority in this country. So this has a lot to do with adolescence, and adolescence, of course, is a major point in the development of an individual's life, because it is during adolescence that the self-concept is being developed, that the individual is undergoing an identity crisis, a gender identity crisis, that the individual is dealing with the issues of self-esteem, dealing with the issues of body image, which is the reason why you see them getting caught up in clothes and other adornments. It is the period of time when an individual looks for social affirmation and social acceptance and looks forward to social belongingness. It is a period of time when the emotions are labile and unstable, and therefore the individual is seeking to bring his emotional, sexual, and other drives under control. It is a period of time when the individual is wrestling with social acceptance, wrestling with alienation from the adult society, the society in general, and alienation from itself. It is the time when the person is engaged in intellectual development. It is a time when the individual is asking and trying to deal with moral questions and make vocational choices. It is a time of egocentrism, a time of status striving and being concerned with clothing and cars and other things. It is a time when the person deals with invidious comparisons. That is, how do I make myself look good by making other people look bad? And therefore, when you look at this social system, it strikes our youngsters at their most vulnerable periods of their lives and seeks to transform them. Now, you may say, some of you who are older, well, you know, we wrestled with the same thing. But keep this in mind, you see, that though these issues are issues that may have been a part of my generation and earlier generations, that these issues are taking place within a different social political context. They're taking place within a different socioeconomic historical context. And it is these contexts that combine to determine whether these issues will develop into positive outcomes, negative outcomes, or conflicting and ambivalent outcomes. So today's black adolescents, particularly the poverty-stricken adolescent, exist in a world that is quite different from the world of his parents. Very different from the world even of the 50s and 60s, because we have a youth now that is engaged in the post-industrial age. When you dropped out of school, there were jobs waiting in some factory or on some shipyard or some other place for you. Those jobs are not there today. And so you have to recognize that these youngsters are dealing with a different world. The computers weren't there when you dropped out at the time and when you miseducated yourself. These are children who are engaged in an information age. These are children who are engaged in a highly urbanized world. These are no longer farm boys and rural people from the rural South caught up in their rural communities. These are kids raised in the ghettos, in the projects, and in the poverty-stricken areas of the urban cities. These are children then that are raised in an information data processing world, a world of television and mass media, a mass media that recognizes that they have money or that they can get money, and now a world that instead of just selling to adults makes teenagers its major marketing audience and therefore creates desires and wishes and plays the cruel hoax on our teenagers by provoking their desires through TV, through singers, through Ray Charles talking about Pepsi to black religious music, and then does not provide them the means by which they are to get the things by which their appetites have been provoked to desire. Recognize this then, ladies and gentlemen. Recognize that we are dealing at a time of rising expectations. You see, when we grew up, we knew that there were certain slots for us, and we didn't have to worry about the other ones. Now we live in a world of rising expectations. Be the best that you can be. Be all that you can be. And we see the result of that. These youngsters are living in a time of family dissolution. Remember, the largest percentage of black children up to the 1950s were raised in a two-headed family. Now we are dealing with children where the vast majority of families are single-headed and in poverty and caught in their situations. So don't be too
war no more. You can't say that. You say, well, we don't need guns. We need books. Shut up, fool. The white man make all the guns. How we gonna go up against the white man? We can't compete with the white man with all the guns. Well, fool, he make all the books. How you gonna compete with him if he makes all the books? You willing to go that route? I was talking to a young Sunni Muslim brother at Mart 125 yesterday. He said, well, do you really think we still oppressed? In America, I'm not lying, as God is my witness. Young brother, but he has a good chance, this young brother. He said, you think we still oppressed? And he went on to show me how things had changed and how we weren't oppressed anymore. He really believed that. And I told him, since I knew he was coming from Islam, I told him that Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, that Prophet Muhammad said, you must stop the oppressor. Stop the hand of the oppressor. Physically stop him. The Holy Quran says, and fight. Fight with those who fight against you. That persecution and bloodshed, that persecution and the murder of your people is worse than bloodshed. The Quran says it's better to go on and fight and shed some blood, but persecution and the shedding of blood and the slaughter of your people, it's not worse than dealing with your enemy and shedding your enemy's blood. Fight. Fight with those who fight against you. It says, and drive them out from where they drove you out. It says, and fight with them until there is no more war. Fight with them until there is no more bloodshed. I told him that Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, stop the hand of the oppressor. Physically, fight him. But Prophet Muhammad goes on to say, if you can't fight him physically and stop his hand physically, speak out against him. Strongly speak out against him. And if you can't stop him physically and stop the hand of the oppressor physically, if you can't speak out boldly and strongly against him, Prophet Muhammad says, then secretly protest in your heart. But secret protest in your heart is the poorest and the weakest form of protest, he said. He said, oh, see, I put his man on him. That's the way we got to be. We got to know all of the doctrines, all of the philosophy, all of the ideology, so we can go after our people and bridge the gap and pull them together and form an African United Front or a Black United Front. But we got to know what they know and then some. So when I put Prophet Muhammad on him and told him that, you know, if you want to secretly protest in your heart, the Nabi or the Prophet said, that's the poorest form of protest. Then he's ready to talk. So the day he saw me, I was over there. He was very excited. He wanted another conversation. So I drop a little something else on him, and he's a good little brother coming along. I'm almost there, if you'll give me just a few more minutes. There would be less police brutality if the masses were armed. Mark Furman's would be hard to find. Mark Furman was not an exception to the rule. Mark Furman talked about the brotherhood of policemen, the fraternity of policemen. He said that the policeman is God. That's what he said. There's a devil saying that the policeman is God. He's judge, jury, and executor. Huh? Right on the spot. He talked about how he used to beat black men and women and Chicano brothers and sisters until he would just beat the waste out of them, beat the mess out of them. He said, then you could smell the niggas and the, you could smell the niggas and the Mexicans or the Chicano. You could smell them. I mean, you could smell them stinking. He said you couldn't get into the jail for the stench coming from them. They just beat them until they urinate on themselves, beat them until their bowels would waste all over. He said he'd grab them and just throw them down the steps, just throw them down. And another cracker down at the other end of the steps or catch them at the other end of the steps, kick them and beat them. No, you got to, I'm here to tell you that the only way you're going to stop police brutality is you got to stand up and be brutal with this damn beast. You got to step to this cracker or it will never stop. You can moan, you can groan, you can sing, you can pray, you can recite, you can claim you know all the Quran, Old Testament, all the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, the Quran from Al-Fatiha to Al-Nas. You can know all the Medunetah. You can know Maya, truth, justice, righteousness, harmony, balance, order, reciprocity. You can name those of the Netter system. You can go and study the Odu text and substantiate your position according to Odu.
You can study the Ifa, or the Word, or the Akan, or the Yoruba, and run through the pantheon of the Orisha. You can call on Oludumare. You can call on Ilegba, and Shango, and Obatula, and Oshun, and Ogun, and Yemonya. You can know all of that. But unless you're willing to stand up and step to this white man, we will never get out of this condition. Frederick Douglass said the limits of a tyrant is prescribed by exactly how far you will let that tyrant go. He won't stop if you don't stop him. It's like any bully. The bully will keep picking on you until you get him to raise up off of you. But some of us will lose our lives. Tupac is gone already. Biggie is gone already. Many of us, Yusuf Hawkins is gone already. Many of us are already dead, and we're dying every day. And while we're here in Queens tonight, black men and women and young black boys are dying at the hands of some cracker somewhere in America right now. I would rather die for a cause than to die because you in some barroom pinching somebody's wife on the booty on the bar stool and get your throat cut with a Miller Lite bottle. It's a hell of a life, man. That's a hell of a way to go. Say your daddy got killed. Say, yeah. How'd he get killed? So he pinched somebody's wife on the booty at the bar stool. The dude picked up a Miller Lite bottle of Budweiser Light and broke it and cut his throat. Is that the way he died? Well, he died in the East Coast, West Coast fight. East Coast? West Coast? You're a damn fool. You'll die over some bullshit? Some damn records? A damn CD? You are what you call a recording studio gangster? Oh, you bad as hell in the recording studio. Ain't a nigga in the world better than you. Capone couldn't mess with you. Babyface Nelson. None of them couldn't mess with you. A recording studio gangster. You just as bad as you can be. You gon' blow, put your gat in the nigga's mouth and blow the nigga's brains out. I'll stomp that hoe. I'll kick that bitch. White man show up, you can hear a rat pee on cut. Nigga ain't ready to fight. Nigga ain't ready to fight. I say we must arm the masses. Most of y'all got guns anyway. You shoot them for the 4th of July. Damn day that ain't even your Independence Day. Yes, you do. You shoot them on New Year's and New Year ain't even in yet. You just got them. They're just toys. Or you'll go get them on your wife. Draw the gun on her because she burnt the beans. For the fourth time, she'll just go order some beans. Or she'll draw the pistol on you because the phone rang at 2 in the morning and you stayed on too long, talking too low. Two or three brothers, so bad. I'm Crip. Two or three brothers so bad, I'm blood. They'll go off into territory of their rival brother gang and face bumper jacks, face chains, baseball bats, pipes, nines, AKs, face everything in a fratricidal war with your kith and kin, your flesh and blood, your brother.
Crack cocaine, sweeping inner city communities. No, actually, President Reagan announced his drug war a few years before crack hit the streets. But once it did, the Reagan administration seized on this development with glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner city crack babies, crack dealers, launched a media campaign, you know, to expose, you know, crack in inner city communities in the hopes of building public support for a drug war they had already declared. And the plan worked like a charm. Our television sets were flooded with images of black and brown, you know, drug users and dealers, crack babies, the whole nine. Our television sets were saturated for nearly a decade with these images. And in short order, Democrats began competing with Republicans to show they could even be tougher on crime than them. Could be even tougher. And President Clinton, you know, boasted outside on the campaign trail. He boasted in front of a prison where, you know, a man was being, had just been executed, you know, a mentally impaired African-American man being executed. He flew from the campaign trail to watch the execution and then stood outside the prison saying, you know, I can be nicked a lot, but nobody can say I'm not tough on crime. President Clinton in office, again, attempting to win over those same so-called white swing voters. He, you know, championed three strike laws. You know, he presided over the largest increase in African-American imprisonment in our nation's history. He and the New Democrats championed legislation barring drug felons from public housing, no matter how minor the offense, denying them from basic public benefits, including food stamps for the rest of their life. Discrimination is now perfectly legal in virtually every aspect of political, economic, and social life once you've been branded a felon. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has, you know, for the most part, turned a blind eye to race discrimination in the criminal justice system. Now, people often ask me, you know, if racial bias is as bad as you say it is in the criminal justice system, why don't you file some more lawsuits about it? You know, how come we don't hear about people filing lawsuits in the news, you know, challenging the bias of police or prosecutors? And, you know, what, if it's so bad, why don't we see more lawsuits about this? Well, what people don't realize is that the U.S. Supreme Court has made it virtually impossible to file claims of race discrimination in the criminal justice system. As I describe in some detail in Chapter 3, the court has closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, beginning with, you know, stops and searches, to plea bargaining, and sentencing. In a series of cases, you know, beginning with, you know, Armstrong versus the United States, McCleskey versus Kemp, the Supreme Court has made clear that only evidence of conscious, intentional bias, the very sort of bias that is nearly impossible to prove these days in the absence of an admission, is deemed sufficient. Now, of course, most folks, including most law enforcement folks, know better than to say, I stopped him because he's black. I didn't give him the good plea deal because he's black. Most people, some don't, but most people have enough sense not to acknowledge their bias openly in the so-called era of color blindness. But the U.S. Supreme Court has insisted on that kind of proof in order to even get in the courthouse doors. The court has, a practical matter, closed the courthouse doors. It said no matter how overwhelming your statistical evidence, no matter how severe the racial disparity, unless you can offer proof of conscious, intentional bias, you do not have a case to make of discrimination in the criminal justice system. And in this way,
you know what I'm talking about. Don't you? All right. I thought you did. He discovered America with all these people here. When he takes something, when he steals something, when he roughs something, when he robs something, when he bum rushes somebody's place and just wipes out whatever they got and run off with it,
is called a discovery. When he has a riot, it's called a Boston Tea Party. These Peckerwoods have a straight-out riot in a harbor and tear up a damn ship, and they call it a tea party. Can you imagine? Call it a tea party. Makes no sense at all. When they wipe out the Indians on TV, it's a victory. But if the Indians wipe them out, it's a massacre. I mean, this guy is forever playing word games. He's just the devil. Yes, sir. As I said here, the first Sunday I came, I have to say it, I know it makes some of you uneasy, but I have to say it just every now and then I have to say it. Because I believe you should remind yourself. Remind yourself to remember, to remember, to remember. Just so you won't forget that the white man is not a devil, but the white man is the devil. You wouldn't be here if some devil hadn't brought you here. Harlem wouldn't be run down if some devil hadn't put us in this condition. Brooklyn, none of it would be run down. Watts in Los Angeles, sections of Detroit, South Side, West Side of Chicago. It wouldn't be run down if some devil hadn't put us in this position. I know some of you love them. Lord have mercy, child. I just love everybody. I don't care what them old Farrakhan and Elijah Mohammed people say. I just love everybody. Lord have mercy, child. I just can't hate nobody. But you hate your black self. If you didn't hate your black self, you wouldn't wear a scary curl. You'd wear it the way God gave it to you, and you'd wear a button saying, I'm nappy, and I'm happy. If you didn't hate yourself, you wouldn't wear it blonde. Blondes have more fun, and you ain't having no fun. What Spike Lee calls wannabe. Girl, you know you're a jigaboo, and we love jigaboos. Don't we love these jigaboos? Because this is God's woman. And when we say jigaboo, we mean you got that strong hat. Like our women got that good hat. Ain't that right? We got good hair, too. I got some. I had to spend some minutes this morning. I was just wearing bald. If I let it grow out, I got good hair, too. I mean, it's stand up, too. Top of my head, just like yours. We say we love everybody, but we hate ourselves. Can you imagine a fellow moon walking across the stage and take scissors or something, cut his nose off and try to make his nose pointed like the white man? Have him to break his jaws and try to take the high pointed like the white man. Have him to break his jaws and try to take the high cheekbones out. Take shots and try to take the color out of his skin. Take some hormone shots and try to take the male out of his makeup. White folks just made them a product. Neither black nor white. Neither male nor female. Just for everybody. Whatever's your thing, I got it for you. I got a product for you. Should wear a stamp on his head saying, Made in America. Because that's the way he was made. That's the way he was made. Made in America.
Died of malnutrition and starvation. Because they could tell by the rotting of the teeth and the jawline. So even though they most likely grew food, they weren't allowed to eat it. And then they found something even more peculiar that speaks to this idea of why he believed we required less sleep. They would show a large frame man, and they would find an injury where the muscle actually detached itself from the bone as a result of exertion and not injury. Stay with me. It detaches itself from the bone as a result of exertion. That means you work so hard, the muscle detached itself from the bone. You don't see those kind of injuries in contemporary society because no one's going to work that hard. Unless, of course, you have a gun trained on you from sunrise to sunset. So we do have empirical evidence of how hard folks worked. Then he went on to say that we were dumb, cowardly, and incapable of feeling grief. Why would Thomas Jefferson need to believe that? Why would he need to believe we didn't feel grief? What was he doing, do you think, that produced cognitive dissonance? You were killing people? Not only were you killing people, beating them, you were selling them, yes? Selling mothers away from their children and husbands away from wives. And surely they don't feel it, because if they felt it, that would make them human like me. So I simply say, and you see, it's not even so much that he said it, but he was an important person. If Joe Nobody said it, but he said it. So what do you think the rest of the folks, uneducated laborers, believed? Well, they don't feel grief, you know. After all, Thomas Jefferson says they don't. So he becomes a critical person in making those statements. But you see, it was all to relieve and to settle the conscience that he died with. But these become very important as you see how these things move forward. Then there was J. Marion Sims. I won't spend a lot of time with him. He's another figure. You can Google him. There's a statue, actually, of him in Central Park. And J. Marion Sims was an individual credited. He was the father of modern gynecology. How many women in here know what a vaginal speculum is? And for those men in the room that we lost, a vaginal speculum is a device designed to open up the vagina. It was considered one of the most important advancements in medicine that was made. He was credited as being the wealthiest physician to have ever lived. And what's interesting about him, you know, look at the medals pinned on him. I was just very curious about how it was they regarded this man, because no one ever really looked at how did he come up with that vaginal speculum. The way he did it was he actually worked on unanesthetized, did experiments on unanesthetized slave women. He created a makeshift hospital in his backyard in the mid-1800s. He built the first vaginal speculum from a pewter spoon. And he reasoned that slave women were able to bear great pain, meaning we don't need any anesthesia, because their race made them more durable and thus they were well suited for painful medical experimentation. We didn't even, you know, because we didn't feel like other women could feel. This man would cut into women, cut into them, and just said, well, since they're black, they don't really feel it. Unbelievable. And more importantly is what he did to infants, because not only did he experiment on women, he also experimented on infants. He said that black infants suffered from something he called trimus nascentium, which is now commonly referred to as neonatal tetanus. Neonatal tetanus originates in horse manure, which was the likely cause of the disease in slave infants. He attributed it to the indecency and intellectual flaws of slave infants together with skull malformations at birth. That is a shoemaker's awl. And that's the 1800s shoemaker's awl. He would stick that into the heads of brand new infants in an effort to realign their skulls based on the indecency and intellectual flaws of their parents to treat the malady. Of course, it was 100% death rate. But that's what he would stick in the head of a baby at birth. And so these are things that are so horrific that you can't possibly wrap your head around it. And this man is, I mean, just Google him. And you think to myself, I think to myself, if I were up here in front of you right now, and this is going to become very important as you move, I move into the other slides, If I stomped a puppy to death out here, up here, just a little puppy, and stomped it right here to death in front of you, most of you would need therapy. And I would be arrested probably faster than killing a black man for killing a puppy. How could you do that? Do you realize how much dissonance you have to remove in order to stick that into the brain of a child? More importantly, the child can no longer be human. Are you understanding what I'm saying? The reason why he could do it is they weren't human. They didn't even feel pain. That's what this man believed. Now, you may look at that and go, those are horrific things from the past. There is a book out right now, not table reading. It's called Medical Apartheid. This is written by Harriet Washington, came out last year. This book chronicles the experimentation on black people up to contemporary day. See, we want to look at the Tuskegee experiments. We want to look at Sims and go, oh, that just still going on. Implicated, Harvard, Johns Hopkins, because we weren't what? Human. So that dehumanization is something that we really got to appreciate went on for a long time. Can you go back? Back one more. No white could ever rape a slave woman. The regulations of law as to the white race on the subject of sexual intercourse do not and cannot, for obvious reasons, apply to slaves. Their intercourse is promiscuous. We've now justified raping black women because they can't be raped. We aren't raping them. They're promiscuous by nature. So we can't do it. Forward, one more. The fact that white men could profit from raping their female slaves does not mean that their motive was economic. The rape of slave women by their masters was primarily a weapon of terror that reinforced whites' domination over their human property. Rape was an act of physical violence designed to stifle black women's will to resist and to remind them of their servile status. These become important instruments that you look at. And I want to give you some statistics as it relates to American history. By the mid-1800s, there was over 600,000 mixed-race children born. 600,000. How many of you know what miscegenation is? Miscegenation is an illegal marriage between people of different races. Actually, it was very profound here. That it was illegal to marry someone of another race. So when you consider the fact that one of the greatest issues and one of the number one reasons why black men were lynched, beaten, and imprisoned had to do with the fear that they were going to rape whom? White women. Now the numbers, I mean, we're talking about pure numbers, numbers alone. It was who being raped? It was black women being raped, but they can be raped. Let's advance forward. Before we get into the Casual Killing Act, the Casual Killing Act was written because of the number of people who were killed by while being corrected. Okay. And if any slave resists his master, owner, or other person by his or her order, correcting such slave and shall happen to be killed in such correction, it shall not be counted felony, but the master, owner, and every other person so giving correction shall be acquitted of all punishment and accusation for the same as if such accident had never happened. So that means that if you happen to be correcting someone and you beat them to death, you know how hard it is to beat someone to death? I mean, I thought about that. I said it happened so frequently that they created a law so that you wouldn't feel any what? No guilt, because you were simply correcting them. It wasn't your fault. So I went back to look at who was beating folks to death. I wanted to know. And it was white women. White women were beating black children to death. That's who was being beaten to death. But it wasn't her fault. She was just correcting them. You see, what we do is we rob ourselves of our own humanity when we refuse to look at this stuff. We rob ourselves of our humanity. And that's what people didn't know happened. Going forward, one more. Then you had the mental health folks. This is how we got in. We got in to try to fix it. In the early years of the 19th century, a physician named Samuel A. Cartwright argued that two particular forms of mental illness caused by nerve disorders were prevalent among slaves. One was drapetomania, which was diagnosable by a single symptom, the uncontrollable urge to escape from slavery. So now what we've done is we've now pathologized your desire to be free. Must be something wrong with them. Keep trying to free themselves. And again, it would be funny if it weren't in journals. You see, all of this is to remove the cognitive dissonance. Now we have, look at all the people joining in. You got Linnaeus, you got anthropology, you got physicians. All of them saying, they deserve it. It's not us. We don't need to adjust anything. And if they just tried harder, how about you people just pull yourselves up from your bootstraps? What's the matter with you? The playing field has been leveled. Well, we're going to see if, in fact, it's been leveled. Or is that conjecture? Move forward. Now, I want you to look at this photo very closely, and I want you to see who's in it. More important than the man hanging, because you got to understand the lynchings that occurred in America happened after slavery. Not during. Thousands of lynchings happened after slavery because this is a reaction to white fear of what we would do once freed. But we didn't create a vigilante group to take out white people, but they did create a vigilante group to take us out now that we're free. See, that happened after slavery. They were called the what? The Ku Klux Klan. They don't wear hoods anymore. They wear suits. But they're alive and well all over the world, even here. So look at who's in the picture. I want you to look at this little girl in particular. You can't see her closely, but she's actually grimacing, like smirking. Now, remember, let's go back to the puppy concept here. She would be loathed and torn up probably if this was a puppy, which means he's less than that, because she's not disturbed. This little girl is not disturbed by this.
We must understand clearly when we talk about capitalism, who are the capitalists? As if we understand that there are only a few people who own and control the means of production in the society, then we begin to understand that there are a few capitalists. And these capitalists exploit everybody because everybody works for them. Everybody sells their labor to them. It is by selling your labor to a capitalist that he's really able to exploit you. Instead of going through theories, let me give some direct example. Let's say that I'm a capitalist. And let's say that I sell shirts. I have a shirt factory. Let's say this is my factory. I own it. The machinery. I have a place where I get cotton. I own it. I'm the capitalist. And let's say you are my workers. You are my workers. You don't know me. You never see me. You see my lackeys, you know, maybe my foreman, but you never see me. Now, let's say it costs me 50 cents for cotton for every shirt I make. And let's say it costs me 50 cents for upkeep of my machinery. That's a dollar. And let's suppose I pay you a dollar for every shirt you make. That means it costs me $2 to get a shirt, labor included, your labor. I pay you for making the shirt. Now, when I sell the shirt, being a capitalist, and you must know something about capitalism, very important. The sole motivating force in a capitalist society is profit. Profit. That is the sole motivating force. Profit. Get money. Get it. Get it as fast as you can. Get it any way you can, but get it. Just get it. Just get it. And even in the African community, this, it affects us here in this country because Africans, those of us living in America, those of us born in America, we are imbued with the philosophy of capitalism, and sometimes we don't even recognize it. Thus, you find brothers and sisters even selling dope to their brothers and sisters to make money. Again, because we're imbued with the philosophy of get some money. Ain't nothing wrong to kill for money. Hell, your country is napalming for money. You can certainly kill for some money. All right, just get it. Just get it. It's the overall philosophy. When we talk about revolution, we must talk about changing values. We must talk about changing values, and we must understand these values. To the shirt factory. I've not forgotten. I'm just going to tie it in. I'll tie it in for you. You will see, you must look under the shirt factory, too. You must look for spiraling economy. That's very important, spiraling economy. I sell the shirt for $5. I don't do anything. You're the one who makes the shirt. I'm exploiting your labor. You toil, you sweat, I get the fruit. That's right, I get it. But you grow it, you plant it by the sweat of your brow. I get it. I sell the shirt for $5. I am exploiting your labor. I really am exploiting your labor. I mean, even when you want a shirt, hey, you got to come to my store and buy the shirt for $5. Hey, I really am exploiting you. Now, you're workers, you're in a factory, so you begin to get social consciousness. Yes, you do. Marx talks about this. Because you're working together, you see the socialized process, the laboring process, and you're able to see clearly how you're being exploited. So you get together, and you start talking about, we want more money. So you tell my foreman we want more money. So the foreman comes to see me. He says, the workers say they want more money. Later for them. Keep them working, man. So he comes back, no raise. They all work, but you all get a little bit more agitated, you know, because it's scientific. The pressure rises, and as the pressure rises, the consciousness must rise. It's scientific. It can't be stopped. That's why revolution can't be stopped. Then you say, hey, look here. We're going to strike. So the foreman comes back and said, hey, they say they're going to strike. I say, oh, let them strike, man. And sure enough, you all strike. Yeah, you all strike on me. Now, when you strike, of course, my machinery stops. I ain't making no money. So after a while, I called my foreman. I said, what do they want? He says, well, they said they want $1.50 more a shirt. They want 50 cents more a shirt. So I said, okay, let them have it. So I bring you back. You happy? I pay you $1.50 more. Right. So it now costs me $2.50 to make a shirt. It costs me $2.50 to make a shirt. Before, it cost me $2. I was selling it for $5. But hey, look here. I can't go out there and keep selling it for $5. Hey, how am I going to do that? I'm going to lose profit. And look here. Since the sole motivating force in a capitalist system is profit, ain't no need for me to come and sell it for $5.50. Hey, no. Next time you see that shirt on the market, it's going to cost you $7.50. Right. Right. And that's what's known as the spiraling economy, because profit is what about wages go up into demands of the workers and prices rocket. Wages go up, prices rocket. And it keeps going and going and going until it's got to blow the top. It's scientifically real. That's why Nixon is talking about freezing wages and freezing prices. He's stupid. You got to freeze capitalism, Nixon. Freeze capitalism. That's the problem. That's the problem. Yes, that's the problem. You must understand these concepts, because once you begin to understand them and master them, you will see the inevitability of revolution. Not only the inevitability of revolution, but you will see the inevitability of victory for the struggling masses around the world once you understand the scientific principles of revolution.
In the 60s, you will see nothing but betrayals by the petty bourgeois elements in our society. The African bourgeoisie is the most corrupt bourgeoisie in the world. In Africa, they seek luxury in the midst of mass suffering. There are more Mercedes in Africa than in any other continent in the world. In America, as soon as they arrive at a position based on the blood of the people, they snatch that position and run away from the people. But you must not think that they represent the people. They only represent their opportunistic self using the people every step of the way. So you must not be confused. It must be clear then, for the 60s, the class struggle in the African Revolution must be more ruthless and uncompromising than in any other revolution. Here then, the masses must come without pity and without mercy to trample upon these reactionary pigs who, after the people have gained struggle through their blood, come to hand back the gains on a silver platter to the very enemy the people fought. This will come as a natural consequence. The people themselves are everywhere screaming that it's time for them to deal with these reactionary pigs. Even in America, they say, our leaders must be held accountable. They're only saying here that these people must be accountable to those who made it possible for them to get there. Thus, not only is the revolution inevitable, but it is clarifying itself and it is qualifying itself. For the African masses everywhere, the clairpoise position now for class struggle has become inevitable and irreversible. The petty bourgeoisie everywhere will be running for cover, but the masses will spare them not. Consequently, we, who have dedicated our lives to the people's struggle, we, who knowing that the people will always be free, we, understanding that we must make a contribution to qualify our struggle since the 60s, have been dedicating all our energies to only one task, the organization of the masses of our people. The organization of the masses of our people. We are not running for mayor. We're not running for president. No changes can come from the top down. We're not stupid. Changes can only come from the bottom up. The masses and the masses alone can make them. If you want to learn something from the 60s, the lesson is simple. Organize the masses of the people. Thank you.
Such as they ensured that the United States would come to its maturity under circumstances, which mean that for a substantial proportion of citizens, life is nothing more than a living bed. Liberty is nothing more than a prison of poverty. And the only happiness we enjoy is laughing to keep from crying. We find evidence for majority freedom and minority oppression in the fact that even while the early settlers were proclaiming their freedom, they were deliberately and systematically depriving Africans of their freedom. These basic contradictions were further aggravated by acts which implicitly admitted that the majority was wrong, but unwilling to do right. Thus, when the Declaration of Independence was drafted, the Founding Fathers struck all mentions of the slave trade. Thus, when the United States Constitution was drafted, the Founding Fathers considered the slaves as equivalent to three-fifths of a man. Thus, when the slaves were emancipated, the descendants of the Founding Fathers compromised that freedom to gain further territory. These compromises were so basic to the thinking of the forebears that legal attempts to correct the contradiction through constitutional amendments and civil rights laws have produced no change in our conditions, and we are still a people without equal protection and due process of the law. We recognize then that the oppressive acts of the United States government, when contrasted with the testaments of freedom, carries forward a basic contradiction found in all the legal documents upon which this government is based. Generation after generation of the majority group have been born, they have worked, and they have seen the fruits of their labor in the life, liberty, and happiness of their children and grandchildren. Generation after generation of black people in America have been born, they have worked, and they have seen the fruits of their labor in the life, liberty, and happiness of the children and grandchildren of the oppressor. While their own descendants wallow in the mire of poverty and deprivation, holding only to the hope of change in the future. The hope has sustained us for many years and has led us to suffer the administration of a corrupt government. At the dawn of the 20th century, this hope led us to formulate a civil rights movement in the belief that the government would eventually fulfill its promise to black people. We did not recognize, however, that any attempts to complete the promise of the 18th century revolution in the framework of a 20th century government, economy, and society was doomed to failure. The descendants of that small company of original settlers of this land are not among the common people of today. They have become a small ruling class in control of a worldwide economic system. The Constitution set up by their ancestors to serve the people no longer serves the people. For the people of change. The people of the 18th century have become the ruling circle of the 20th century. And the people of the 20th century are the descendants of the slaves and the dispossessed of the 18th century. The Constitution set up to serve the people of the 18th century now serves the ruling circle of the 20th century. And the people of today stand wanting for a foundation for their own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. The civil rights movement has not produced this foundation, and it cannot produce this foundation because of the nature of the United States society and economy. The vision of the civil rights movement is to achieve goals which have been altered by 200 years of change. Thus, the civil rights movement and similar movements have produced no foundation for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They have produced humiliating programs of welfare and unemployment compensation, programs with sufficient form to deceive the people, but with insufficient substance to change the fundamental distribution of power and resources in this country. Moreover, while the movements attempt to get minorities in the system, we note that the government continues this pattern of practice which contradicts its democratic rhetoric. We recognize now that we see history repeating itself, but on an international as well as a national scale. The relentless drive for profit led this nation to colonize, oppress, and exploit its minorities. This profit drive took this nation from democratic capitalism and underdevelopment to bureaucratic capitalism and overdevelopment. Now we see that the small ruling circle continues its profit drive by oppressing and exploiting the people of the world. Throughout the world, the proletariat is crushed so that the profits of the American industry can continue to flow. Throughout the world, the freedom struggle of oppressed people are opposed by this government because they are a threat to the bureaucratic capitalism of the United States of America. We gather here to let it be known at home and abroad that a nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness has in its maturity become an imperialistic power dedicated to death, oppression, and the pursuit of profit. We will not be deceived by so many of our fellow men. We will not be blinded by small changes in form which lack any change in substance of the imperialist expansion. Our suffering has been too long. Our sacrifices have been too great. And our human dignity is too strong for us to be prudent any longer. Black Panther Party calls for freedom and power to determine our destiny. The Black Panther Party calls for full employment for all our people. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to the capitalistic exploitation of our community. The Black Panther Party calls for decent housing for all people. The Black Panther Party calls for an educational system that will tell us the true facts about this decadent society. The Black Panther Party calls for exemption from the military service. The Black Panther Party calls for an end to police brutality. The Black Panther Party calls for freedom for all political prisoners and prisoners of war. The Black Panther Party calls for trials by members of our peer when we're brought to the court, and justice. The Black Panther Party calls for a United Nations plebiscite to determine the will of black people as to their national destiny. Black people and oppressed people in general have lost faith in the leaders of America, in the government of America, and the very structure of the American government, that is the Constitution, its legal foundation. This loss of faith is based upon the overwhelming evidence that this government will not live according to the Constitution because the Constitution is not designed for its people. For this reason, we assemble a constitutional convention to consider rational and positive alternatives. Alternatives which will place the emphasis on the common man. Alternatives which will bring about a new economic system in which the rewards as well as the work will be equally shared by all people, a socialist framework. Alternatives which will guarantee that within the socialist framework, all groups will be adequately represented in decision-making and administration which affect their lives. Alternatives which will guarantee that all men will obtain their full manhood rights, that they will be able to live, be free, and seek out those goals which will give them respect and dignity while permitting the same privileges for every other man, regardless of his condition or status. The sacredness of man and of the human spirit requires that human dignity and integrity ought to always be respected by every other man. We will settle for nothing less, for at this point in history, anything less is but a living death. It is a fact that we will get change. We will transform the society. It is up to the oppressor to decide whether this will be a peaceful thing or proper means that is effective regardless of the consequence, because it is our conclusion and our principle that a slave who dies a natural death will not balance two dead flies on the scales of eternity. We will have our manhood even if we have to level the face of the earth. So I would like to say that we are one tonight. Let us be one in the future. Power to all of the people.
Here we are. Here we are. Here's for the people.
Egyptian mummies on a flag or a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youth, cause it's not like the future depends on it. But save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a car, keep on and all of a sudden you are there in Indiana Jones. And I keep all the gold and keep all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzi I've ever seen and I've ever known. Put the words on this place that the world can see and it's all that will ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like we'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast, but the way them go flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them feet can't defeat and them could have never clown. A spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord.
Yeah. Sabali. Patience. That's what the old folks told me. Can you get with that? Discovering a world before this world. A world buried in time. Uncovered with rhymes. It's no realer.
We born not knowing, are we born knowing all? We growing wiser, are we just growing tall? Can you read thoughts? Can you read palms? Can you predict the future? Can you see storms coming? The earth was flat, if you went too far you would fall off. Now the earth is round, if the shape changed again everybody would have start lost. The average man can't prove up most of the things that he chooses to speak of. And still run research and find out the root of the truth that you seek of. Scholars teach in universities and claim that they're smart and cunning. Tell them find a cure when we sneeze and that's when their nose starts running. And the rich get fixed up when we get cut. Wanna heal them broken bones in the bush with the wet mud. Can you resign? Can you restart? Can you make peace? Can you fight war? Can you milk cows? Even though you drive cars, can you survive against all odds now?
It's crazy. When you feed people the truth, you don't know how they're gonna react. You're scared of wrongdoers, people that's just ignorant. You're scared of the truth. For now, who wrote the Bible?
Bible? Who wrote the Quran? And was it a lightning storm that gave birth to the earth and then dinosaurs were born? Who made up words? Who made up numbers? And what kind of spell is mankind under? Everything on the planet we preserve and can it. Microwave it and try it, no matter what, we'll survive it. What's you? What's man? What's human? Anything along the land we consuming. Eating, deleting, ruining. Trying to get paper. Gotta have land, gotta have acres. So I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch niggas play the game like the Lakers. In a world full of 52 fakers, gypsies, seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, throw salt over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a doll of me. Sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit. I'm fearless, I'm fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul. It's like a military soldier, since 7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Dang. To all the wisdom and knowledge seekers of the world. Sabali. Patience. Yeah.
Looking menacingly at a white woman. Vagrancy, loitering. 10, 15 years for that. Here's the kicker. 25% of people under convict lease die. More than during slavery, because you don't kill off your property that you need to work for you. But they didn't have any protections because they have another label, do they not? And when you're going to oppress the subjugated people, what must you do? You must justify by relabeling them, but not only are they black, genetically inferior, lustful, careless, governed by caprice, but now they're criminals, which then justifies what we do. So 25% of them died under convict lease. But look at how lucrative it was. Convict leasing was so successful that by 1898, nearly three-quarters of Alabama's total state revenue came directly from this institution. So then the trauma continued. But y'all free, right? Let's move on. So then we had, oh, Lord, we got it now. Separate but equal. Is it equal now, friends? Still separate, though. You know where the Negroes are. Well, we're doing gentrification in Portland, but you know, we know where the black folk are, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
You know where to find them, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's no, you know, sign on the freeway that says next left hood. But we know when we're there, don't we?
Keep it real.
Okay. Separate,
never sold tickets. They had excursions, caravans, train rides to see a major sporting event. A nigger lynched today. Two niggers lynched today. Three niggers, four niggers lynched today. Billie Holiday would sing the song of Bessie Smith, one of them, about trees in the south with a strange fruit with blood at the root. This is the strange fruit. The black man, black woman, Billie Holiday. Take pregnant black women, bring them out in front of other black women, strip them naked. There in the Holocaust, you can stay right there, brother, right in the Holocaust Memorial, they had piles of shoes, as though I was supposed to be impressed. And they said, well, over in Germany, we have just rooms full of shoes. They took all of the personals of these people from them. Wasn't that cruel? I said, God damn it, we didn't even have shoes. You can't pile those shoes up in a room for us because we didn't even have shoes. When they took us from Africa, they stripped us of our diamonds and our gold and our silver, our material resource, our spiritual resource, and our human resource.
Yes, sir.
And when we came here, most of the time we didn't have shoes. We went barefoot. Huh?
Right.
Stripped the black woman of whatever little tattered rag she had. 9 months pregnant. Tie her up. Tie tie horses to one leg, horses to the other leg. Beat the horses, make them run in opposite directions until they rip and pull the black woman apart and the unborn black baby fall from her, and a no-good cracker would bring another black woman out, her stomach full 9 months with the fruit of her womb, take his knife and stick it in her full stomach with the roundness of her stomach, rip it open and stick his AIDS, syphilis, gonorrhea hand inside and snatch the unborn black baby from her, throw it to the ground and crush the baby's head with his boot heel, and make other pregnant black women watch so that the adrenaline of fear would course its way through her veins and bathe her brain. A man to be paid back. Got to get back. I need some get back.
During Reconstruction, you don't have no balance unless you have the two of them working together for the balance and harmony of the universe. All praise is due to Allah. We're on the one God, and we're on the fact that we always believed in that one God. And so there in the holy city of Abydos, at the sacred temple of Seti I, in the so-called hieroglyphics or in the Medunetta, we find the first creation story where the God, the black God, what kind of God?
Black.
Where the black God, Ptah, through authoritative utterance and divine will and creative force and power,
right,
gave utterance and called and willed the universe into existence.
Right.
And so the Holy Quran says that he said, Kun fayakun. Kun fayakun. Be, and it is. Be, and it is. Kun fayakun. And the Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And he said, let there be this, and let there be that, and let there be light. And there was light. And the light, it says, then began to harmonize with the darkness. So let there be light. Kun fayakun. Be, and it is the authoritative utterance that the Africans, do you read in the hieroglyphics or the Medunetta, that Ptah Hotep, through authoritative utterance, willed and called the universe into existence.
Yes,
in another part of Africa, we called him Amen. In another part of Africa, we called him Amun-Ra. In another part of Africa, we call him Aten. All over Africa, we believe in the one God. We have always believed in the one God, the one power and force behind the universe. The white man ain't never had to teach us nothing about no God. White folks don't believe in no God. The only God that the white man believes in is himself. When he says on the back of the dollar bill, in God we trust, it's him that he's trusting in. When it was time to go and raid Noriega in Panama, he didn't call a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Negro Uncle Tom, boot-licking, butt-licking puppet Colin Powell, the Negro and his staff, and call them all in and say, we're getting ready to attack Panama. Let us bow our heads and say a word of prayer. Do you think Bush did that? Do you think he said, our Father, who art in heaven? Do you think he did that? When he got ready to attack Brother Maurice Bishop, the leader of the New Jewel Movement in Grenada, do you think Reagan and the boys called a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and spent it in Congress and had a moment of prayer before they did it?
No,
and if they did, they were doing it to themselves. They said, load up the troops, the guns, and the ammunition, and let us go.
That's right.
When it's time to launch one of their spaceships, they don't say, let us bow our heads. They say, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. They start the countdown and counting, right? He believes in no God except himself. And so he will make up a mystery God, but then he'll give you a son that looks like him. with blonde hair, blue eyes, and pale skin, and tell you that if you see the Son, you've seen the Father, because the Father is in the Son, and the Son is in the Father. So if you see a white man as the Son, your subconscious has to suggest to you that the Father must be white some kind of way also to produce a boy like that. Your mind has to say that to you. And here, as we look at it, we again have always believed in one God. In fact, all of the other people of the earth get their religion from us. The black, the brown, the red, the yellow, all of them get their religion from us. I got a bag back there with a big book in it that I need right at the table. It's in the kitchen, I think. Brother Jamal knows where it is. No matter what land you go to, they believed in what we had given to them. You go among the Mexican-speaking people, they believe in a black savior, a black messiah, who has a strange set of circumstances surrounding his origin into the world, who comes from a black Mary or a black Madonna. I just need the book out. I didn't want to give Pier 1's a plug up here. Pier 1 Imports a plug up here. Among the Greeks and the Romans, they always believed in a god that we had given to them. In Greece, it was Zeus. And Zeus was a black god. In Greece, they also had Apollo. You hip to the Apollo Theater in New York. They had Apollo. Apollo is a black god. In Rome, they even worshipped a black woman as the goddess of Rome, Isis. In France, they worshipped her. Because when you study the etymological root of the term Paris and Paris in French, you will find that it is linked to the root of the name Isis, and that at one time the city, back down the wheel of time, came from the name Isis. I'm talking about Paris. You had Fuhai of China, Zaha of Japan, and I mentioned those who speak Spanish. You had Quetzalcoatl. You had Krishna of India, which means the blue or the black-skinned one, blue-black-skinned one, or the purple-skinned one, Krishna of India. And you see many groups of white people throughout America today who worship the black god Krishna. You see them with their head shaved and a little ponytail or a little ponytail, running up and down the street, beating a gong and hollering, Hare, Hare, Hare Krishna, whatever the hell they say.
Damn it, it was the devil that killed Brother Anthony Baez. God damn it, it was the devil that shot our brother down on the streets of Brooklyn, shot him 24 times. It was devils who killed Brother Yusuf Hawkins. It was devils who were responsible for Eleanor Bumpus. It's devils who killed Jerry Lee Amy and Eula May Love. It was devils who brought you here on the slave ships to the hells of North America. You better remind yourself every day. They moved on Mel Reynolds. They moved on all of them. Look what they did in Clinton's Congress. They moved on all of Clinton's people. Did you know that? Clinton had 5 so-called minority appointees. We ain't no minority. We outnumbered this speck of wood 12-1 on the face of the planet Earth. But he had 12 so-called minority appointments. The Clinton administration had these 5. Michael Epps, the black former Secretary of Agriculture, gone. Huh? Ron Brown, Secretary of Commerce, they killed him. But before they killed him, they charged him with misconduct from his office of the Department of Commerce. Huh? Energy Secretary. Huh? Hazel O'Leary. Huh? And a couple of others. What happened during Reconstruction? white folks became angry, the white male. They're talking about an angry white male today. And so the white man's ego got involved. He blocked the entrance. Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, down in Georgia. Bishop Henry McNeil Turner of the AME Church. Policemen lined up in front of the door of Congress and would not let Bishop Henry McNeil Turner go in. And he had been duly elected by the people. We were even governor. Pinchback became governor of Louisiana. But every position we held, the cracker rolled back the hands of the clock. In the twinkling of an eye, when he got ready, he said, no more of this foolishness. A nigger ain't to rule over me. A nigger is not to be a sheriff over me. Nigger sheriffs arrested white folks? Hell no, he said. Give me that badge, nigger, and get back in a nigger's place. Some of you who are undercover agents sitting in the audience, your job is temporary. And if you continue this, your life is temporary. Over a short period of time. Temporary over a short period of time. Temporary anyway, but we mean over a short period of time. You come in among black people and spy on black people. Negro judge on the slave theater with no more better judgment than that. See his brother persecuted by the criminal justice system that he's been a judge of. He obviously didn't read Bruce Wright. He obviously didn't see what Alton Maddox was doing for black people. And so a Negro boot-licking judge who owned the slave theater, now it sits there with rats and roaches running all over the damn place. But because white folks put pressure on a nigger judge, the nigger judge padlocked the door and told the white folks, I took care of it, boss. I took care of it for you, boss. Did I do a good job, boss? I put him out, boss. Is that a good nigger, boss? They say, well, nigger, we got something else for you to do. White man knows he can't trust you. If your own people can't trust you, the white man knows he can't trust you. So your job is a temporary job. You come and sit in this audience and go and report back to the white man. We see you, nigger. We see you. Your wig is crooked. Your Jerry curl got too much juice in it. We see you. And as this nation gains freedom and independence, and as more and more of this revolutionary spirit rises up in the minds and hearts of the people, we will kill you for coming to betray the legitimate aspirations of our people. Oh, yes, we will. It's the year of the bullet. Or the bullet. But some of you are not willing to pay the price. You want to come here for years and just listen to great speakers. Go home and listen to great tapes. But when it's time to move with the leadership to buy your own land, to buy your own building, so that nobody can dictate whether a padlock is put on it ever again, then you don't step forward. But you cheer louder than anybody in the damn audience. You eat more bean pie on the outside. You buy more bean pie than anybody. You got all the tapes at home. You got a library of tapes. Dr. Ben said. Dr. Clark said. Dr. Akbar said. Just a constipated Negro. Your brain is constipated. Your heart is backed up. Afraid to stand up. There are enemies among us, and we must find them and get rid of them. It's a shame that Eugene Roberts still lives walking around New York after he's responsible for the murder and the assassination of Malcolm X. But Eugene Roberts is doing interviews on television. He's a goddamn celebrity. Dr. Felder on the front row with Gene Roberts' picture, exposing him. He does interviews now. He's a celebrity. An undercover agent in the OAAU of Malcolm X, seen in the Audubon Auditorium, pretending to give him artificial resuscitation. I'm just telling you what the people are telling me on the streets, the real radical ones. They saying that he should be dead. That's what they're saying. I ain't got nothing to do with it. That's what they say.